Welcome to this podcast conversation, which is part of the podcast Öresund. The theme for this episode of Öresund is understandings of COVID-19 in the Öresund region and also with a further international outlook. Invited to the conversation are two people who in their research have been interested in the disease COVID-19 from a medical anthropological perspective. With me today is Raquel Garcia Plaza, who is a visiting doctoral student at the Department of Arts and Cultural Sciences from the Universidad de Salamanca in Spain, and Rachel Irvin, who is a lecturer at the section of ethnology within the Department of Arts and Cultural Sciences department here at Lund University. I will introduce you in more detail shortly, but first I just want to tell you a bit more about the context of this conversation. My name is Johanna Rivano Ekedal, and Öresund is a podcast from the Center for Öresund Region Studies at Lund University, of which I am the director. And the mission for the center is to shed light on different types of borders that become apparent in a transnational region like Öresund, a region that consists of and affects more than one country. And we use the Öresund region as an empirical research site to test how different borders take shape here. And based on the idea of the border as both a barrier and a motor for change, the center is a platform for critical discussions on issues relevant to a variety of transnational processes, such as migration patterns, environmental and climate issues, identity and politics, cultural heritage and technology, for example. And language and language use is, of course, also a central issue for us to highlight in different ways. And I just want to mention that the podcast in itself is a result of the pandemic. As Corona made it much more difficult to meet physically, we started this podcast, of which this conversation is a part. The podcast is then a platform for sharing experiences and knowledge, and with it, we want to contribute with inspiration and knowledge to both academia and the general public. Today, we will learn more about the stories that emerge around a virus that travels across borders, affecting people in ways that are shaped by the specific geographies in their countries. Raquel Garcia Plaza, you are a physician coming from the Basque County in Spain, and you're working in the emergency department. And you're also a PhD candidate with a soon-to-be-finished PhD about the socio-cultural epidemiology, that is a difficult word for a Swedish speaker, of the COVID-19 crisis in the medical anthropology field at Universidad de Salamanca. You have approached the COVID-19 crisis from a mixed methodology, combining quantitative analysis regarding social, economic, demographic, political and cultural variables affecting the incidence and mortality of COVID-19, as well as the stringency of the measures taken by the governments. Then you performed interviews in 8 different countries: Namibia, Botswana, South Africa, Mozambique, the USA, Cuba and Sweden and Denmark, trying to understand the experience of the pandemic in these different communities. Welcome. And Rachel Irvin, you are a medical anthropologist and docent in ethnology at the Department of Arts and Cultural Sciences here at Lund University. And you also have a background in health policy. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, you looked at how the Swedish handling of the pandemic was discussed and debated in international media. And in your research, you found that there was a lot of misinformation and even disinformation, and a lot of international media tried to interpret the so-called Swedish strategy with outdated or stereotypical ideas about Swedishness. And in the autumn, you're starting a new project with colleagues from Norway and Denmark, funded by Nordforsk. And then you will be looking at Nordic, European and global cooperation in vaccine diplomacy. A warm welcome to you both, and I hand over the floor to you two.
Great. So, Raquel, you did interviews in Denmark and in Sweden. So I don't know if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about the kind of interviews that you did in the Öresund region.
Sure. My interviews are kind of short. They are 5 to 10 minutes long. And I really had an interesting experience interviewing both populations, because I could see the cultural differences between them. When you approach Swedish people in the street, you really need to be very careful and cautious, because you get the sense that you're invading their spaces, and you really need to address the participant to be comfortable when you're interviewing them. You could sometimes see the fear in their faces, like, why is a stranger talking to me? And that happened less in Denmark. They tend to be, or tended to be, more open or more happy even to be interviewed. So that's an interesting difference between the cultures of two countries that are so close to each other. But all of them were very polite, both in Sweden and in Denmark. So that's, it's not something about being rude. It's something about the sense of maybe personal space or, in you know, privacy. So it took, I performed 20 interviews in each country, and it took way longer to interview people in Sweden than in Denmark. But it was interesting, though.
I can say it. I get a sense of panic when people come up to me on the street and they want to talk, and I think, oh my gosh, what does this person want? Why are they talking to me? And I used to have American exchange students in Stockholm who I would teach, and they would come, to Stockholm and study, and I would send them out to ask random Swedes on the street what they thought of the Swedish healthcare system. And it was this mix, too, where they said that, you know, certain Swedes would just have this panic look on their face.
Absolutely.
Usually they'd find one person who really wanted to talk a lot.
Yeah.
But what did you actually ask them about?
I asked how was COVID experience here, wherever here was. If they have COVID, if they know personally a lot of people that have had and died out of COVID, if they experience fear, if they believe that COVID has had an impact on society, and what do they believe it's the worst part of the pandemic? And a very interesting question was, how was the government's attitude here towards the pandemic, and if they believe that it was appropriate or too strict or too relaxed? So they would share their opinions over that. It was interesting. I wanted to explore if people struggled, what people considered that was important when addressing the pandemic, and you know, what did they, what's their point of view on the government's policies?
What was their point of view on the government's policies?
It's interesting because Sweden had a more relaxed policy type than Denmark. And some people will address that they were at first concerned about that relaxed approach. And people in Denmark felt safer for some reason, like, okay, the government's taking care of us or something like that. And I would have some answers, some people both in Denmark and in Sweden answering, well, yeah, Sweden was more relaxed, but at the end of the day, it worked for us. But, well, mortality in Sweden has been higher than in Denmark, although the policies around testing have been lower. So that's kind of interesting to explore, because that kind of means that the people here in Sweden value, or might value more, another aspects of the pandemic rather than proper healthcare epidemiological data, maybe social aspects. I've also found more people agreeing with the policies here in Sweden than in Denmark. Most of the Danish population believe that their government were too strict, but most of the Swedish people interviewed believe that their government policies were appropriate. So, I don't know, that's interesting to address. There are more than just epidemiological data that shapes the experience of the pandemic.
One thing I also wondered a little bit was about the timing, because, of course, you were interviewing people in 2023 at the tail end of the pandemic, and then after, when the pandemic was more or less over. And I kind of wonder, how do you think it would have been different if you had been able to interview people in 2020 or 2021? You know, how do people's feelings about their government's handling of a pandemic change over time?
I would have loved to be able to travel during the first peaks of the pandemic. That would have been very interesting when it comes to analyzing data. I think that maybe here people were less panicking, or at least I got that sense now in 2023. I don't know what would I have found in 2020 or 2021. But there's other places, like probably the US, where I believe that people panicked more. during the first waves of the pandemic. So I don't know if I would find a lot of differences here in Nordic countries, where there's a rather high institutional trust. But in other countries, I'm sure that I would have found a bigger panic environment. I would have loved to travel first 2 years of the pandemic, but it wasn't an option, obviously. I started doing my interviews in July 2022 when the pandemic was, I wouldn't say over, but under control. And vaccines were out there and a lot of people were vaccinated. So you could grab a plane with a mask on, but still grab a plane. So, but this is a very interesting question.
I mean, I think people were panicking. I was thinking about this today. I remember washing my groceries, not washing all of them, but like you're buying ice cream and washing the tub. And because we didn't know how it was spread. We still thought, oh, you know, is it airborne? Is it droplets? Is it fomites? And so there was a lot of questions around, you know, what is this thing and how is it spread? So, and of course, people were hoarding, you know, buying extra toilet paper, those kind of things. I don't know if the same thing is panicking, but people were scared because we had no idea what was going on.
There's something about uncertainty that, I don't know, it's an interesting concept because we all understand rationally that we don't know things. And obviously, if there's an ongoing pandemic, it just has popped up now. Science is not built, we are building it. So we all understand this rationally. But when it comes to you personally, there's an emotional feeling of, okay, but I want to know. Like, I understand that we don't know everything, but this unease that you can feel when it comes to you personally, I mean, we're human beings and we're emotional beings also. So I think that the pandemic has also brought that up a lot. What do you think?
I think, too, I think there was a degree of, shall we say, racism in the beginning of the pandemic. And what I mean is that I think living in Northern Europe, there's this idea that, like, disease is something that happens other places. Like, disease is something that happens in Africa or Asia, but it's not a thing that happens in Western or Northern Europe. And I think that governments, some researchers, myself included, were not as concerned, you know, in January or February of 2020 because we thought, oh, well, this is, I'm not suggesting that anyone was like explicitly racist, but I think there was this implicit idea that, oh, well, disease is something that happens someplace else. It's not going to come here. And I think if we had not had that mentality, then maybe we would have started acting sooner. And by we, I mean certain governments, certain researchers, of course, not everyone.
There's a sense of like, it happens to the other, like othering.
Yeah.
And it's between countries, but it's also within countries, like risk population. No, only old people die, like the other. Yeah. I'm young, therefore I'm not at risk, therefore whatever. So yeah, when you othered, if that's a verb now, pathologies or conditions, you might have a rather selfish approach, which is not great. But I believe that's something, I don't know if something that's something here in Nordic countries or in the global north. That I definitely see that also in Spain and in other places like the US. Like, this is not happening here until it is.
I mean, you can see the same thing with like the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, one or two cases get imported to the U.S. and people flip out. They're not, but they think of Ebola as something that happens over there in this other place.
Yeah, that's something beautiful in a poetic sense of the pandemic, that it has been everywhere. It has affected wealthy countries, less wealthy countries. It has affected rural areas, urban areas in a very different way, of course. But everywhere you go, you talk about coronavirus and you will get a reaction. Everyone knows what it is. So that's why I wanted to understand it in different countries.
So obviously you're looking for a cross-cultural comparison and you're looking for differences. But what similarities did you find, though? I mean, if you talk to people from 8 different countries, is there some sort of universal COVID experience?
Oh, yeah, there are some similarities. And that's a beautiful question, actually. everywhere I've been, I did this question, like, what are you afraid of? And there's a common pattern that people have felt fear, first of all. So we're all human beings. We all have emotions. We all have fear. And that bonds us to some extent. And people have been afraid of their own health, but they have been very afraid of their loved ones. That was a very common answer. Like, I didn't want my mother to get sick. I didn't want my husband or my grandfather or whoever to get sick. So I think that the love for others is in our DNA, is in our nature. And that's worldwide. And I've had that in Cuba, and I've had that in South Africa, and I've had that in Denmark and in Sweden. Like, that's universal. So also, like, in a romantic way, love also bonds us in a very deep way.
And do you see that in terms of long-term effects of the pandemic? And, you know, people are focusing on the negative long-term effects of the pandemic, and we can talk about that. But do you think there's any positive long-term effects in terms of love, relationships?
Do you mean in the Øresund region or in worldwide?
Worldwide or in the Øresund region.
Worldwide, when I ask, what do you believe it's been the impact of the pandemic? Those are very different answers depending on the country. Focusing here in the Øresund region, I've received quite often that people value more their social interactions. Like, they will say, I missed this Verde, or I missed this event, and I really missed being around my grandkids or being around my group of friends that would have coffee every Wednesday or whatever. So you would have this sense of people have missed being around each other. And so I think that my analysis as a researcher is that social interactions and being around our loved ones has gained importance in people's imaginary or in people's values, what people value. So it's the beautiful side of a pandemic, if you will. Like, it brought people more together. If you want to see the bright side of it.
I do want to see the bright side, but I also want to see the dark side.
Yeah.
What do you think are some of the long-term effects that are not so great based on what people told you?
Probably mental health issues. A lot of people struggle through depression, anxiety, feeling lonely. Of course, issues related to health, like not being able to work out as often as you would, or, yeah, all the anxiety that can come from uncertainty, that could come from being in the middle of a pandemic and really being afraid of what's going on. I think that that's also worldwide. I've found that in a lot of countries, but also here in the Øresund region, that has created a footprint, I believe, in our generation that I'm not sure how will it look in some years' time. It's a good thing that our generation at least tend to be quite open when talking about mental health. So I'm glad about that. But I hope that psychologists do a very nice job with our mental health during these years.
Mm. Yeah, I guess if we think a little more specifically back from going from the global back to the Øresund region, when you interview people, how did they discuss cross-border issues, sort of cross-border?
Yeah, that was very interesting. So little context, Sweden has been more relaxed in their measures against COVID than Denmark. So while in Denmark, cafes or restaurants were closed, in Sweden, you can come here and grab a coffee or eat with your friends. You still had some restrictions. You couldn't seat more than a certain number of people per table, and you weren't completely free as before, but you were here in Sweden more open than in Denmark. So I've had people from Denmark, old people, telling me, yeah, our kids, our young people went to Sweden, went partying and grabbed a sense of normality, and then they got COVID and they came back. So that's not the point of a lockdown, guys. And I've also had people from Sweden expressing, Danish people can come here and they will have a sense of normality and do their get a haircut, for example, or grab a coffee, but I cannot go there. I also want to go there and grab a coffee. So I think that this sets value over the how easy it is to cross the border and how in touch these communities are, and the fact that it was a different policy in its side of the border. I think that made both Danish and Swedish people upset. I've also have a couple of young people, both in Sweden and Denmark, telling me that they, since they are young, this border was settled, like this bridge was set in 2000. So people that, like, I was born in 1996. So I understand that my generation had grown up with a very easy crossing border. And I had a couple of answers telling me that they have grown up crossing the border like it wasn't even a border. And all of a sudden, it is a border. So they believe that something has been like ripped off of them. Like, I'm on my right to cross this. And who are you to tell me that I cannot cross to my neighbor's place? And it was also a struggle for people commuting. There's a lot of people working in Denmark and living in Sweden and the other way around. So, yeah, the difference between the policies between in both sides of the border, I think that didn't bring anyone together.
Yeah, I remember it was really difficult because, so I live in a small town just outside of Lund, and it's on a hill. And so if it's, as long as it's sunny, I can see the bridge. And many people can see the bridge because it's huge. And I remember walking out March 2020, and it was like 3 hours before the bridge was going to close, or the border was going to close. And, you know, standing at the edge of town, it's a beautiful day, it's sunny, and it was just the strangest thing looking at that bridge and realizing that instead of being a connector, all of a sudden it became a barrier, a border. And it was really strange feelings, and it was a really strange feeling not to go to Copenhagen for, I mean, it was probably a year and a half that I didn't go to Copenhagen, and it was really strange.
Like this barrier.
Yeah.
I mean, the bridge closed, or the border has been more restricted back in 2015 with the refugee situation. Like, it's not the first time, but I mean, I think that it's beautiful that the overall situation, the general situation of the border is that it's not felt as a border, but as a connector. So when something happens and it becomes a border, that's weird and strange for people here. And that thing that's beautiful. The fact that it's usually a connector. Also, did you have like the sense that you were living something like historical? Like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. This is really a thing going on.
Well, I mean, I'm a medical anthropologist, right? So of course I thought it was something historical. But like I said before, in the beginning, January, February, I really didn't take it seriously. I thought it was going to just sort of pass over. I didn't realize how historical it was until borders started to shut. And that's when I thought, wow, this is actually something.
I mean, no one knew at all what would happen. There were people being very chill. I was very chill before Spain lockdown. And then I also had this like, oh, okay, this is getting serious. But of course, as we said before, if there's an ongoing process happening, you don't know. Like, science didn't know. And we still don't know a lot of things. We still don't know a lot of questions. So, yeah, how could you know?
But I think it's this idea of uncertainty too, which is really interesting, how the scientific community tried to handle uncertainty, and I don't think always that well. And I think one example is that there was someone who wrote an article, and I think it was in the British Medical Journal, but I forget. Maybe it was in a different journal, and they were making this point that usually scientists tend to be humble in the sense that, you know, we're very clear that, like, oh, we don't know this or that, or when we write articles, we're very clear about the limitations. And then sometimes the media can take a scientific article and turn it into something very certain, like this causes cancer or, you know, new cure for cancer, those kind of extremes. And this article that I'd read, they made this point that all these sort of backroom discussions that we would have had around the science, the evidence, we were having those debates in real time in mainstream media. Which meant that people who are not used to dealing with uncertainty or data were having all kinds of opinions and viewpoints that maybe weren't the most useful. And at the same time, because there's been different types of vaccine hesitancy and in different countries, you know, views on what the government should or shouldn't do, I think scientists have in some ways not been as humble as they normally would have. And you see people going out in media and being saying things like, oh, well, this is, you take the vaccine, it's going to work, this or that. And I think if we talk about vaccine hesitancy, I think it would have been a lot better for governments to be clearer and say, look, this vaccine is going to prevent severe disease, but you can still get COVID. Because what's happened over time is now people, you know, who are vaccinated say, oh, I got vaccinated, but I still got COVID. What's wrong with this vaccine? And I think if we had communicated better in the beginning to say, yes, this vaccine is going to keep you from getting severe disease, but you can still get sick, I think it would have been a bit more humility, a bit more honesty about the limitations of the data, of the evidence, and of vaccines, other diagnostic tools, for example. I think it would have helped.
I agree. I think that overall, people, the communities, they have a sense that science is the science, the truth, a fact. Like, in a very, like, prone to positivity, like, I'm positive of this. And as you said, that's not how science works at all. When we write, we always tend to, like, this might express this, this is a hypothesis, this might lead to that. We are very aware of our limitations. And it's very rare that you read in a paper, this is a fact, this is the truth. And I believe that that's great because that's how science is built. And if you're very certain of your ideas, you probably won't be able to build more. But we, as researchers, we cohabit with that uncertainty really easily. But society, I don't know if they always do or they always understand. Like, as you said, if as a scientist you say, you express what the false positive is when testing or a false negative or the fact that you can have COVID even though you're vaccinated, and that makes total sense. Some people might see that as, we don't know, therefore we are not even looking at it, or we are stupid, or we are not, and that's not true. But yeah, if the COVID-19 particularities had been expressed in a more pro and cons way, like black and white, like there's a whole grayscale happening here. So how do testing work? Why can you have a negative test even though you have symptoms? Why can you have a positive test even though you had a negative test 3 days before? Like those things that might not make sense if you don't know, if you don't have a medical background, which not everyone needs to have. They should have been addressed in a clear way, probably. And I think that the way you communicate a pandemic in this case, both the vaccine, the testing, the incidence, the mortality, really shapes the population's opinion. It's beautiful to address that in Nordic countries, in Denmark and Sweden, the institutional trust is very high. But I've interviewed people in societies with a lower institutional trust, like the US, and they would have more radical opinions, more in a more polarized society, and COVID has been very politicized there. So that would have been avoided to some extent if the information was communicated in a more clear, maybe relaxed way, instead of that having a, you know, someone in the government expressing, I don't know, maybe drink bleach if you have COVID or something like that. It's a Actually, when I was in the U.S. and I would ask about how the pandemic was lived here, I got a lot of answers about how information was spread and was communicated. And I've never had that answer here, neither in Sweden nor in Denmark. So I think that people here are okay with how it was communicated overall. But in the U.S., I would have a lot of people answering me like, we missed proper, truthful, clear information. coming from, you know, scientific people, like not political parties, not a, not an opinion, but a, you know, evidence. What do we know? What don't we know? Where is this going to? What are our policies and why? So yeah, absolutely. That's actually another, probably a future study. It might be like how a pandemic or healthcare crisis should be communicated and what's important, what people need to know, what they don't need to experience. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. I think it just goes back to, I think part of the reason why the scientific community was not, look, I don't want to speak for everyone, because obviously there are some really fantastic communicators that went out there and were like answering great questions at press conferences, calmly, you know. And I remember watching the WHO press briefings, and they were just so calm and under control and honest about what we knew or didn't know. And I always felt very like calm and relaxed. So those were fantastic press briefings, I think. A really good example. But yeah, it's hard to communicate this uncertainty. And sometimes if you are up against, you know, parts of society who are saying, drink bleach, take this antifungal medicine, do this or that, of course, I mean, the gut reaction is to become polarized and say, no, that's stupid, don't do that. And it is hard to push back against that in a nuanced manner and to say, yeah, we're not sure, we don't know, but we're working on it, we're doing the best we can. And that's, I mean, honestly, that's what people did during the pandemic. If you think about everyday life, everyone was doing the best that they could. Everyone from, you know, the person working at the supermarket to someone who was trying to develop a vaccine as quickly as possible. Everyone was doing the best they could.
Yeah, that's also a general sense. Like, no one chose to experience this, but people cope with it as best as they could. And again, It has been a hard time for a lot of people, but it has also brought some interesting values or principles that might have gotten forgotten somehow. So yeah, I agree that people cope with it as best as they could. And I mean, I'm very glad that it's officially over now, according to the WHO. But yeah, it's been very different in different places of the world, and I don't know, I find it very interesting.
I wanted to ask, when you talked to Swedes, did any of them talk about vaccination in relationship to the narcolepsy scandal from H1N1 in 2009?
They did.
Okay.
They did. They brought that topic up in some like 4 or 5 interviews out of the 20 interviews I did in Sweden. And I found that very interesting. I don't know if the audience is into context, but a brief summary. In 2009, there was a conflict around a vaccine against H1N1 influenza virus that was related or associated with some narcolepsy cases in infants. And they researched over that, and there might be a biological reason for that. Not necessarily related to the vaccine itself, but more with the virus. However, a lot of Swedish are aware of this association and were maybe afraid of this or not. So when I interview people here and they tell me about that, I couldn't avoid thinking, even though there has been this conflict like 10 years ago with a vaccine having a long-term side effect here in Sweden, people were very compliant with the vaccination. Everyone that I interviewed here were vaccinated. If this conflict happened in another society with a less developed institutional trust, such as the US, for example, would people hold onto that, like to avoid vaccination or to... Like, I think that it would have created way more hesitancy and way more conflict, even though there is already a big anti-vax movement in the US, and it would have made it way worse. But here, again, the institutional trust that shapes these societies really came up, and I think that's very, very interesting. Very interesting.
I have a thought about vaccination I was going to ask, and now I've completely forgot about it. It was about side effects, yeah. I mean, I think that was one thing. Even when you talk about anti-vaccination movements and side mm-hmm. effects, you know, if we have a drug where the side effect is 1 in 100,000, that's not usually a big deal. And I know, I mean, obviously it's a big deal for that person depending on what the side effect is. But when you're, you know, vaccinating 4 billion people at the same time, all of a sudden 1 in 100,000 is a lot of people. And I think that also has fueled some of this anti-vaccination movement where you're seeing a lot of side effects simply because of the numbers, because there's so many people that were vaccinated at the same time. Which is, it's, of course, it's scary. I mean, some side effects, right? You know, you can deal with them. A little bit of pain at the injection site, this or that. But I mean, some of them, I mean, people have been very, very ill, and there's side effects that, you know, have led to deaths as well. So it is very scary. I mean, it's scary. So I understand why people.
It is, but at the same time, there is not a drug that doesn't have a side effect. And as you said, if you're vaccinating 10 people, it's unlikely that you have those side effects. But if you're vaccinating the whole population of the world, you're going to see those side effects, and that's normal. Again, it might be scary, but it's normal. And it's just how science works. It's how medicine works. So again, if you communicate those side effects, if you address that the vaccine has some risks, but the benefit of it is that it has prevented a lot of severe forms of the disease. Therefore, it has probably prevented a lot of mortality. The risk-benefit balance worldwide is very, it has demonstrated to be, how would you express this? Like,
but I think part of the problem is too, I think in public health is we have this different difficulty talking about the individual patient versus at a population level. So normally, well, we'll put it this way, right? Because I just had a baby. Mm-hmm. I used to care about the population level, right? Like I was interested in maternal mortality, infant mortality, and I was completely interested in the population level. Then I had a baby, and all of a sudden, I'm very interested in the individual, and I stopped caring about the population level. And I think this is what we're seeing a little bit with COVID-19, is that it's easy from a public health perspective to talk in the abstract about the population level, the 5 in 100,000 that have a side effect. But then when you're in a pandemic that's affecting you and your family and the people that you love, all of a sudden, those side effects like blood clots or other very serious side effects, you start caring about those at an individual level, which is very emotional.
Yeah, again, there's a fight between rational and emotional processes happening here. Yeah. And you're right, like you care about population-wise knowledge or health or whatever, but when it comes to you personally, it gets very emotional. And still, if something, in this case a vaccine, avoids or helps avoiding the severe form of COVID-19, that's still an effect that you want for yourself, even though you risk yourself to the side effects. So, I mean, the population level studies are there to analyze if it's worthy or not to get the vaccination in this case, or if it's worthy or not to test, for example, or if it's worthy or not to perform A or B treatment. For example, when testing, at first in the pandemic, testing rate were very high because we all wanted to know if we had COVID or not because we didn't have a vaccine. Therefore, it was if you had COVID, you really need to have to be very cautious when not spreading it. But once there's a vaccine and the testing policies were not that sharp, maybe you wouldn't, like if you had a mild case of a flu-like virus, you really don't need to know if it's COVID or the flu or another virus. If your symptoms are mild and you're going to do the same, like your decisions as a patient and as a doctor are going to be the same. You need to take care about the resources you have and the information that it provides to you. So even though you need to deal with that uncertainty, you should be able to cope with that uncertainty at an individual level. But of course, if you have a higher policy maker, in the government or the WHO, that ensures this is due to this reason, and you understand that, it's easier for you to cope with that uncertainty. So again, communication is important.
But I think testing is so interesting for two reasons, maybe three. I mean, one is that testing rates have been like all over the place. And that was why it's so hard to sort of compare across countries, because people's testing strategies differed. And especially in the beginning of the pandemic, before we had the rapid tests, it takes a lot of resources from the health system to be doing the PCR testing. So you don't necessarily want to test all the time. If you have a mild case, there's no point in testing. It's nice to know that you have COVID, but it doesn't make a difference clinically. But at the same time, you know, I love this idea of like some sort of Star Trek future where we have a rapid test that will tell you exactly what you have. Because it shouldn't make a difference, right? Like, I don't want to blame anyone, but I have had the occasional student who emails me and says, I'm sick, but you know, I have a stuffy nose, I'm coughing, but my COVID test was negative. Should I come to class? And I just want to scream into the computer, no, you're still sick. You don't have COVID, but you clearly have something else. Don't come to class. And I know that this did start to happen in, you know, anecdotally in some cases where people have said, oh, well, it's not a COVID. I don't have COVID, so I can go out now. You still shouldn't go out when you're sick. But it would be really cool if we did have testing to know, okay, what do I have? But does it always make a difference? Yeah, you should still stay home, you know, rest, don't infect other people. And testing does take a lot of resources, even if we're not taking resources from the health system. You know, all those rapid tests, a lot of plastic. And again, it's one thing if it's, you know, one person's individual plastic waste, but you start thinking about, okay, say I took three COVID tests times 8 billion people. It's a lot of plastic. But yeah, I think testing, it's this ultimate question of what do we do with that knowledge? You know, from a scientific standpoint, I want to know as much as we can know, but we can't always do something with that knowledge.
Yeah, it's all about what it takes for you to make all those tests and what information it's going to provide to you, what we're going to do with that information. So it makes a lot of sense that at the beginning of a pandemic where we don't know what's going on, how severe it's going to be, how many people are going to die, we don't have a vaccine, you, as a scientific community, you need to know how bad the situation is or can get. But once we have vaccines and they're safe, and once we have somewhat learned to coexist with the virus, maybe all that resources and all that waste should be properly organized. Like, if it makes sense for me to test you if you have COVID or not, I will. And I have the sources for it. If you're pregnant or if you're having a severe case or if you're a risk person for whatever reason, it makes sense. But again, if you're someone that is not at risk population and you have just mild symptoms, maybe we don't need to know like every possible COVID case that there is around. Like, you don't need, if you have a flu, would you test for a flu? If you have just a runny nose, would you test for everything? Like, I think that it's not necessarily at this point.
Yeah. So I think I kind of want to start wrapping up a little bit. And I wanted to go back to the idea of the, you know, Øresund region. I think you kind of already got into this, how the Danes describe the Swedish handling and vice versa. But I kind of want to push a little further into that and ask, did you learn anything about Swedishness or Danishness? And is Swedishness even a thing? Is Danishness even a thing? But did you learn anything about these two countries?
I think I did. First of all, I feel that there's a lot of politeness here. People tend to be friendly and polite. They are maybe more open in Denmark to talk to strangers. And I believe that here people in Sweden, they value more their personal space. So that's a cultural difference there. I was shocked by how peaceful and logom people were here in Sweden. Like, I don't get the sense that people panicked. And of course, someone might. But overall, there's a feeling of, okay, we're good here, we're okay, chill. In Denmark, I got the sense of they have missed more. social interaction, which makes a lot of sense because they were in a lockdown more strict than here. So maybe that the Swedish calm and Danish friendliness, it's also somewhat there in the background of the COVID-19 experience. And I also had a couple of people, one person from Denmark and one person from Sweden, telling me that it looked like the war was the other way around for a moment, because allegedly people in Sweden are more famous for being more strict or more rigid somehow, and people in Denmark are famous for being more friendly and more relaxed and more chill. And all of a sudden, their governments had like the opposite perspective or attitudes towards the pandemic. And all of a sudden, the Swedish government is like super relaxed against COVID-19, and the Danish government is comparatively way more strict. And people were like, that's like the other way around. We usually are the other way around. So a couple of people told me that, and they were surprised by it. So actually, Danishness and Swedishness might be a thing around.
Yeah, I mean, I could say I kind of came to the conclusion in the pandemic that you can't really ideas around Swedishness and Danishness. They're always in movement, right? And I think it also depends on what perspective, who you're coming from, and what point you want to make with these national identities. And I found, yeah, I mean, I think that's what I kind of came to the conclusion, that you can't define Danishness or Swedishness in general, but it's something that gets used, even weaponized, depending on what point you're trying to make.
Mm-hmm. As a person that you're from the U.S. and you've been living here in Sweden for 7 years?
No, 12, 13.
12, 13 years. Yeah. What have you seen about Swedishness and Danishness?
I will say this one. Maybe this isn't the most applicable thing, but I remember, obviously, it's very sweet. It used to be very Swedish and very Danish to, like, you know, shake someone's hand, right? I mean, this is very, very normal, completely normalized. And last year, so 2022, I was in a social event, and this guy put his hand out to shake my hand. And I felt, this is a very Swedish thing, I felt like I had to take his hand because it would have been rude not to. And I would have created conflict not to shake his hand. But then I got stuck into a conversation with him for about 5 minutes. And the whole time I kept thinking, oh my gosh, I need to find hand sanitizer. And so I think that's the kind of thing where it would have been very normal to shake someone's hand. And now I just flipped out completely because I wasn't expecting that, but I couldn't say no to shaking his hand. And I guess that's what I mean. You know, social norms, identities, they're in movement. And I think that's definitely my final conclusion about the pandemic, is that now I prefer not to shake people's hands.
That's also fair.
Okay, so thank you. I have been enjoying listening to the two of you speaking about this pandemic, both in a global perspective, but also how it has been experienced on both sides of Öresund, and actually how we often, in a global perspective, tend to be viewed the Nordic countries as very similar. But in your research, you have also shown, yes, there are similarities, but definitely there are also differences, even if it's just a very narrow strait between our countries. And I've really enjoyed listening to the two of you, and I wish you the best of luck with the defense of your thesis, Raquel, and I look forward to hearing more about the research coming from both of you about vaccines and pandemics. And thank you so much for participating.
Thank you so much for the chance of speaking about the interviews and the research that I've been performing here in this podcast, and for hosting me in this beautiful university. And thank you personally, Rachel, for being my contact person here in Lund since, I don't know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and for the chance of staying here and learning from this beautiful cultural space.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and contributing so much to our department in the past couple of months.
Tack så mycket.